Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This is not going to be a good conversation, but it's only going to be for a half hour. Well, the news took up a few minutes, and we've got to play some commercials, so that gets us down to around 20 minutes. And I'll natter on with the phone number and other stuff, like this rambly intro, so that takes a few more minutes out of it. So really, this painful discussion on invasive insects, it's nearing its conclusion before it really ever got started. But this is important stuff, and state entomologist Judy Rosowski did block out time this morning to be on with me, so it's best that we get going on this, and then our discussion about lanternflies, adelgids, borers, and scales will soon be over, but alas, the threat of them will not. Judy Rosowski, I want to thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint and making us take our bitter pill this morning about invasive insects.
Well, I'm not sure I should say thanks. Quite the intro.
I've downplayed it. I've undersold it as much as I possibly could, Judy. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Judy a question about invasive insects, now's the time to call us, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And, I am making light of it, but Judy, how much do invasive insects worry you?
Well, it's my job, so they worry me quite a bit. And we do have some fairly destructive ones here in the state and on the horizon. So it's true that your gloomy introduction might be warranted.
So they do more than just bug you, right? I mean, they can wreak havoc, correct?
That's true. I mean, so the big one that we have right now in the state is emerald ash borer. And I know a lot of people are aware of it and what it is because we had those purple box traps up and people found out what those were, which was a great help to those of us working in this area. But people aren't really going to start seeing the damage from those trees for a few years yet, except if you're in central Vermont or up in the islands where there are some heavy infestations. Mm. But those are real tree killers, buzz killers too, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, you've worked on your shtick before we had you on. Well, why are you concerned about invasives overall? I mean, do they do this kind of damage to their own native territory that they do when they come into a place where they're invasive?
Great question, and usually not. In fact, one problem we had with the emerald ash borer was nobody in its native country knew about it. It's not really a problem over there. So we were kind of starting without a lot of information about it because it just wasn't a pest. But we found out a lot more now. In its native country, it has native and natural enemies, you know, parasites, predators, fungi, things that kill it and keep that population fairly limited. But over here, it's like a great big grocery store with no guards. You know, all you can eat and say.
Wow. The emerald ash borer said, hey, this is where I need to be hanging out. Where is the ash borer from originally?
It's from Asia, parts of Asia. And, we think it came over here. One of the reasons that we're seeing increased numbers of major invasives is that we've had an increased volume of trade. You know, it's a global world now, as we say. And when you have that much movement of materials, you're going to bring some of the insect world and other creepy crawlies with you.
Yeah. Well, the latest to get their mugshot hung in the office of every entomologist in the state is the spotted lantern fly, which sounds kind of great. But introduce us to this little varmint.
Right. So the spotted lantern fly is fairly new. It was found in Berks County, Pennsylvania in 2014. And we think it had been there at least a year or two before that. You know, these things don't take out an ad in a newspaper when they arrive. You have to find them destroying something, and then you're like, oh, uh-oh.
What's doing that?
Yeah. And so usually when you find an invasive insect, the first step is to try to eradicate it. It's to try to eliminate it from wherever it arrived. So they tried valiantly, but the population was pretty well established. And this is an insect that can hitchhike really well. It, you know, they're not great flyers, but they can fly a bit, and they hop. And they, if those of you out there listening remember the gypsy moths, they lay eggs the way gypsy moths do. And so when you have a lot of gypsy moths, they're laying eggs on everything that isn't moving. They'd lay an egg on you if you didn't run away. So, and spotted lanternfly are like that, and their egg masses are gray, and so they can, you know, blend in on a tree, on a truck, on a car. So they just moved out into the surrounding countryside pretty quickly, and then they've been found in New England states and New York, and they've expanded it. Their populations have expanded into other states. So, you know, we don't have them here in Vermont yet, but I anticipate they're going to make their way up here either by hitchhiking or through natural expansion of the population.
I hate to tell you this, but I have a sister in Berks County, Pennsylvania, so I'm afraid that you're going to have my car impounded now, so I can't leave Vermont. But do they take out any specific type of trees?
Yeah, they're in the insect order Hemiptera, which are the insects with what we call in the trade sucking, piercing mouth parts. We don't just say that to be rude. It's like they have a straw, you know, like a juice box straw.
Sticking
to the plant. And so, unfortunately, they go after some commodities that are important to Vermont, like grapes and hops, and they can do damage to those. They're not a tree killer the way emerald ash borers can kill trees. They do attack trees. They like walnut and willow. They'll go after red maple and sugar maple. They have a lot of hosts that they'll attack. And I'm pretty sure they don't kill those trees. They might stress them, but maybe young trees, the regenerating trees, could be damaged. But the main problem they cause is they're a real nuisance. Because they're like an aphid, they secrete honeydew. So they secrete this sticky green ooze, and when there are a lot of them, it will coat everything in your yard with sticky green ooze, and then that will get sooty mold. So you'll have moldy, sticky lawn furniture, decks, you know. So they're a nightmare as a public nuisance, and then they're, you know, an agricultural pest.
Well,
they're just a lot of fun.
Yeah, they sound fabulous. I'll invite them to my next party. You said they like hops. Please stay away from the hops. Our next guest is Sean Lawson of Lawson's Finest Liquids. He is not going to love the lanternfly, and I hope he doesn't cancel on me after he finds out about the lanternfly. What do they look like?
So they're a fairly unique-looking insect. The great thing about them is you don't have to worry about people identifying them because as adults, they have sort of these pink spotted wings, and then when they open the wings up, they have a striking red and yellow body. And in their earlier life stages, the nymph stage, they're either black with white spots or they're red with black spots. So they're pretty easy to identify. That way. So that's one good thing about them. At least if you're going to be swarmed by an ugly, sticky, oozing, nasty pest.
Yeah.
Pretty.
Yeah. Is it the Dawson fly that is about the scariest thing on earth? This sounds like the antithesis. Mm-hmm. It's actually quite lovely. Hey, let's take a call. We've got Mary in Randolph Center joining us. Mary, thank you for calling Vermont Viewpoint. Go right ahead.
Yes. Good morning. So I'm wondering what we can do as, you know, as homeowners, as, you know, citizens of Vermont, what can we do to maybe identify or stop these?
That's a great question. Everybody is on guard now, Judy, so what can everyone do?
Yeah, so, Rick, don't go visit your sister. That is a great question, and we just ask that if you're in an area that has spotted lanternfly, that when you return, you check your belongings thoroughly for any of the adults or the nymphs or the egg masses, depending on the time of year. You know, just you could even take your car to a car wash when you get back or before you leave wherever you've been, just to make sure you're not bringing hitchhikers with you. You know, it's hard to stop these things once they get here, but it really depends on citizens' vigilance in not transporting them out of the areas where they occur. Thank you. That was a great question.
It was a great question. You can also go to vtinvasives.org. There's some great information on what these bugs look like and where they're being found and things like that. What is the association or affiliation between the spotted lanternfly and the rather satanic tree of heaven?
Right. For a while, we thought that the spotted lanternfly required Tree of Heaven. It needed to feed on Tree of Heaven in order to complete its life cycle, so to lay eggs and have those eggs hatch and successfully grow up. We thought it might need Tree of Heaven, and we thought we were in luck in Vermont because, as far as we know, we don't have a lot of Tree of Heaven. And I'll just remark that Tree of Heaven is another invasive plant, so if you do find some and you want to get rid of them, I would encourage you to do that.
Yep.
But it turns out, and so Penn State and the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture have really been knocking themselves out trying to figure out this insect and how to deal with it. And they have determined that it can complete its life cycle feeding on other plants too, not just Tree of Heaven. So unfortunately, and I think some of the butternut is one of them and walnut. So the trees that we do have. So that's too bad.
I hate to say this, but I believe my mom's neighbor back in Pennsylvania, I went to look up a Tree of Heaven, and I'm pretty sure there's one there in that yard. So that means the spotted lanternfly is probably going to be hanging there in my own neighborhood sometime soon in Pennsylvania. This is all going from bad to worse, and I'm going to be the person bringing in the spotted lanternfly. If they don't actually kill trees and plants, why worry?
Well, sorry, they do kill some plants, like grapes aren't very happy when they come by. And they can probably kill small trees if there are enough of them on it. But, you know, like a big, robust landscape or forest tree isn't going to succumb to them unless it's already stressed and weak. So that we don't have to worry about them. And the other somewhat good thing about the spotted lanternfly is it is basically a great big aphid, and that you can treat it with insecticide. One difference, I'm just going to compare it with the emerald ash borer, is that boring insects are inside the tree. They're hard to get at in a cost-effective manner. But the spotted lanternfly are going to be there in a big mass all clumped together, and you can treat them with a regular insecticide.
But
so
Judy,
it increases the cost of agriculture.
They also like to hide.
Yes, they do. It's true. If they are hanging out on your grapes and you go out to spray them, they might have moved off into the woods to get out of the heat of the day. And there you are, and there they aren't. That was a surprise to some folks.
All right. But to follow up on Mary earlier, they can be treated. They can be sprayed. But if anyone finds them, they should contact your department, I would think.
Yes, absolutely. Because as far as we know officially, there's no established population in Vermont, and we hope to keep it that way. History suggests we won't be that successful, but you never know. People learn, and we might be getting better at keeping insects out of the state.
So let's move on to the emerald ash borer. You spoke a little bit about this buddy of ours earlier, and it's now in Vermont, some clusters in central Vermont in the islands. Will we lose all of our ash trees, and if so, how quickly?
Yes, so the mortality rate for ash is almost 100% if the trees are not treated with an injectable insecticide. which obviously isn't practical on a forest level scale. I should say the Agency of Natural Resources, Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation is spearheading the introduction of biocontrols. Mm. So there's a group of tiny stingless wasps that attack emerald ash borer larvae or eggs. And so we've been slowly introducing those to some of the areas of heavy infestation. I should note that we have 11 out of our 14 counties have at least one location where we found emerald ash borer. So they're fairly widespread, but it takes a while for those populations to build up to the level where you'll start seeing all the ash trees dying. And so the point of the biocontrols is that once most of the trees, the ash trees, have been killed, and this won't happen overnight. This is it will take a while depending on how long that population has been there and how big it's gotten. Then the hope is that the biocontrols, the little wasps, will keep the emerald ash borer population low enough so those ash trees can grow up to reproductive age and produce seed and perpetuate the species. So really what we're looking at is maintaining ash as a tree species on a landscape, and we are hoping that this biocontrol introduction will do that.
We're rooting for the wasps in this battle against the borers. So that would be very helpful if the wasps can do that. I'm no fan of our next most wanted insect, but I love the name. As a matter of fact, if you allowed it, I'd probably keep one as a pet, the hemlock woolly adelgid. And are they here?
Yes, and kudos to you for getting that name.
Thank you, Judy.
People have never heard of an adelgid. Yeah, so we do have them in Vermont, unfortunately. They're in three counties, in Bennington, Windham, and Windsor County, but mostly in Windham. And our cold weather has been protecting us from them and their expansion for the most part, but we had a really mild winter last year, and instead of the usual 70 to 95% winter kill, we only had about 30% of them dying off.
Ugh.
So that might allow them to expand their population a bit. We're hoping that we just get a nice frosty winter this year and it will knock them back down.
Hmm.
And we do have an external quarantine for hemlock woolly adelgid. So we have some rules about whether and where you can bring them into the state from. We are in the process of revising those rules, but that hasn't been completed yet. Oh, which reminds me, if I could just mention about the emerald ash borer.
Yeah.
The federal government has decided that the quarantine hasn't been effective in preventing the spread of that insect, and they want to move their resources into the biocontrol program. So they have now, as of January 14th, they are deregulating emerald ash borer. So if you're in the wood product industry, you might just want to check with your destination states to see what, if any, of the rules have changed about transporting logs.
Oh, interesting.
Thank you, Rick, for letting me say that.
Well, please, who informs the hemlock woolly adelgid that they've been quarantined and they have to do better than humans at avoiding contact? They also have a friend, the elongate hemlock scale. What is that all about?
Well, thank you. Boy, you've gotten a real education in the insect world, haven't you?
I have.
Yeah, so the elongate hemlock scale is similar to the hemlock woolly adelgid. And unfortunately, the two of them have a synergistic effect. So when they are both on a hemlock tree, it is worse for that tree than when any of them is on there separately.
Mm.
And we found they seem to move through the nursery trade. We found two infestations in northern Vermont, and we've treated one and hope the second one will be treated. So we're just trying to, they're in southern Vermont, but ideally we hope we can just keep them, down there and contained. That's the plan.
Is there a reason why the hemlock is so popular with these reprobates?
I'm not sure. Maybe they just specialize on that tree. Hemlocks aren't all that competitive with other hardwoods. Just in general, you only find hemlocks in really horrible terrain because that's the only place they can outcompete the other trees.
Oh, interesting.
So maybe that makes them yeah, more vulnerable to these pests, or maybe they're just specialists.
Yeah.
So they certainly blasted the hemlocks in Massachusetts, but we're just fortunate to be that much colder.
Wow. Well, do we have any invasives to fear from our northern border?
Maybe. Oh. Well, I've been keeping an eye on a couple. There's a spruce budworm. We had this huge outbreak about 40 years ago, and there's a big outbreak in Quebec, but they so far seem to have contained it fairly well. You know, I mean, we learn each time these insects come through different techniques and management practices, and so we're keeping an eye on that one. And then there are a couple other wood-boring beetles that, you know, nobody sees or hears of, so they don't really care, but we're keeping an eye out for them, and we have a good trapping program to make sure if they do get here that we'll be able to find them.
All right. I've got my faith in you, Judy Rosofsky. Protect us, please. You know, a lot of them are moving north each year. We've seen this with ticks. How much is climate change affecting the move into Vermont of these insects?
Well, you know, in general, insects like warmer winters. It's a lot easier on them. And so even the emerald ash borer can be limited by really cold winters. So as it gets warmer, we are probably going to see a more rapid expansion of some of the nastier invasives. And we're seeing that, you know, potentially with the hemlock liliadelgid. So, yeah, climate change is not our friend.
And Judy, yeah, what can we do to avoid as much as possible bringing in these insects into Vermont?
Yeah, don't move firewood. And if you go to Pennsylvania, check your car. You know, and just sort of be aware and alert. We're going to find these things. Spotted lanternfly is going to come in on plants or trees. You know, check plants when you buy them. If they've got something on them, then let the nursery owner know. Or call me.
All right. Well, yeah, I hope your phone isn't going to be ringing off the hook and people aren't finding these things, but it's a distinct possibility. Judy Rosofsky is Vermont State Entomologist. Judy, I want to thank you for making this as painless as possible this morning.
Well, thank you so much, and say hi to Sean. He's a great guy, and we all love his product.
All right, sure will. And to get a good close look at the spotted lanternfly and to learn about all the invasives, you can visit vtinvasives.org. Really great website. CBS News Update is next, and we do turn to return to speak to Sean Lawson of Lawson's Finest Liquids here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren's Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren's Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I wish I could be as good as our next guest. First of all, he takes water and grains and other stuff, and he does some hoodoo to it all, and he creates some of the most wonderful beers brewed in the land of the best beers on earth. Top that off with the company being very socially responsible and add in an amazing commitment to bettering his community, and it's a pretty amazing combo. He is Sean Lawson, CEO and founding brewer of Lawson's Finest Liquids. Sean, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
It's
absolutely.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Sean about his beers or his business, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sean, we're going to spend some time about the talking about the brewery's commitment to social responsibility, but I really want to start with the beer. And as I remember it, I was hearing about this guy in the valley making a great beer, selling it at the farmer's market. And before I could get down there to buy it from you, I wandered into Blackback Pub in Waterbury, and the bartender suggested a Double Sunshine. And it was this moment of revelation. I'm guessing that you heard that a lot back then. You probably still do today. But early on, it must have been really great when someone tasted your stuff for the first time and said, wow.
That's actually one of the biggest rewards of brewing beer, Rick, is when the product and the experience of drinking one of our beers brings a smile to someone's face and leaves a memorable impression. And you had mentioned hoodoo a little earlier. I call
yes.
it a little sprinkle of magic, and
yeah.
Something in the combination of four simple ingredients of water, malted barley, hops, and yeast yields this wonderful finished experience of the beer. And the Double Sunshine was really our first home run beer that people started driving to Vermont from really all over the place to buy and to try.
What got you started brewing, Sean?
I was a student up at the University of Vermont back in the late, I'm dating myself, 1980s and early 90s, and a friend of mine introduced me to home brewing. He invited me over one day and said, hey, you want to try some of my home brew? I said, absolutely, and he cracked open a couple bottles. I tasted it. I was like, wow, you made this? He's like, yeah, I made this. I'm like, this is better than anything you can buy in the store. So can you show me how? And he was like, absolutely. So I ran out, got myself a kit, and a couple of weeks later, we were cooking up my first batch of homebrew, which was a maple wheat ale inspired by one of the beers that the Vermont Pub and Brewery was making at the time. And that got me started down a lifelong path of passion for brewing.
That's fabulous. Was I right about you selling it at the farmer's market early on?
Yes. When I started, it was with a lot of sweat equity in a small building next to our house in Warren, Vermont, that some friends of mine and I built for the brewery, and it was a one-barrel operation. That's only 30 gallons at a time. It didn't go very far. So I sold the beer, and it was a hobby business. I had a full-time job as forester with the state of Vermont, and I started out part-time with the brewery selling beer down at the Warren store, and the pitcher in an American flatbread on tap.
Wow.
And then I started doing the farmer's market, and that because there are so many visitors from away to the Waitsfield farmer's market, it's that really helped get some exposure for our early efforts at Lawson's Finest Liquids.
Now, Sean, you've always struck me as a pretty humble guy, but doesn't naming your brewery Lawson's Finest Liquid sound a bit braggadocious? Did anyone try to dissuade you from using the name?
No, actually, it was a great friend of mine, Jeff Berkovitz over at the Spark Center, who used to call my efforts Lawson's Finest back in the homebrewing days, and it just stuck ever since then. I was like, that's a great name, and there's so many breweries that are, it could have been Lawson's Brewing Company, because that's kind of the common nomenclature, but it struck me as it'd be a great way to stand out as a bit unique.
Yeah, brilliant name. Well done. It really deserves being called Lawson's Finest, most definitely.
Thank you. Appreciate that. You mentioned the work that I've done over the years, and I, couldn't have done it without my partner and co-owner in the business, my wife Karen, who supported the effort from its early nascent days as a part-time hobby to today's successful business.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. Whenever I say you, it really should be the plural in this case, between you and Karen. So
I asked her to join us on the interview today, but she took a pass.
I'm happy
to put in a good words on her behalf.
Okay.
She really is the steward of our social impact
program. Oh, that's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah,
what is it that you think makes your beers stand out so much, even in a place, like what I said, the best beers on earth right here in Vermont?
Well, there are so many great breweries in Vermont, and what I think what we share in common is a dedication and a passion for quality. And, you know, a lot of breweries say that they make quality beers, but Vermont is one of those places where we, you know, we stand out from the crowd. When I started, there were only 1,500 breweries in the country, and today there's, I believe, over 8,000 small breweries all over the country, and it's a lot harder to stand out today. But it's really been passionate about and dedicated to excellence from the beginning. I set out to try to make, you know, some of the very best beer in the world, and it's, you know, attention to detail, selection of ingredients, and never compromising for the sake of cost. And I tip my hat to, you know, all the Vermont brewers out there who really share that passion for you know, excellence and really trying to make some of the best beer in the world. And it's wonderful. It was fortunate and a bit of luck for me to be in Vermont and to start back in 2008, because this is a great place to make beer and a place that's known for the quality of its beers.
Now, you've also stood for being a socially responsible business. Why has that been important to you and the brewery?
From the very beginning, giving back to our community has been one of our core values. And even with the one-barrel system in the first couple of years, it was, you know, it wasn't making much money. But part of what I wanted to do was give back to the organizations and the nonprofits here in the Mad River Valley that support those in need with for food and economic security, people who are just having a tough time of it. One of the great organizations we've supported over the years is the Mad River Valley Community Fund. And so as our business has grown over the years, so too has our ability to give back, not just here in the Mad River Valley, but throughout Vermont, with a focus in central Vermont, Washington County. And before we opened the Waitsfield Brewery and Tap Room, which we did back in 2018, my wife and I traveled all over the country looking at different business models and tap room operations to see what lessons we could learn, what we really liked, the things that we didn't like, and borrowed some ideas from others. And one of them is this what we had used to call the no-tip program, is now known as our Sunshine Fund. And we went to a few different breweries, and instead of the servers accepting tips, the brewery paid their service workers a full-time wage and benefits. And in lieu of tips, they would encourage guests to donate to a charitable organization of their choosing. And so we adopted that model when we opened in Waitsfield. And it's been an incredible success, way more than we could have imagined from day one, just how generous our guests would be in donating to the nonprofits that we select, which rotate every month as part of our Sunshine Fund, one of the social impact programs that we have.
It is one of the things I love about the tap room that you've built. And if anyone's not been there yet, it is definitely worth a trip to the Valley and to visit it in Waitsfield. Sean, Lawson's has just been chosen to be one of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility's champion members. What is that, and why were you selected?
Thanks for asking, Rick. Yeah, it's a great honor for us to be selected as one of VBSR's champion members. And it's in recognition of a number of different areas, but one is how we take care of our workers at Lawson's Finest, the benefits that we offer to our employees, and our giving back to the community are two of the standout areas that they noted in a letter inviting us to join other members. And we're joining a great crowd of standout businesses there that are champion members at Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. So it's a great honor for us.
Yeah, it really is an impressive list of wonderful businesses around the state. And you've also made quite a commitment to solar power. Tell us about that.
Yes, when we built the brewery in Waitsfield, the first project that we did was installing solar panels on the roof of the brewery. We covered the roof entirely. And, you know, brewing is a very energy-intensive business. And so we're well aware of the impact of using a lot of energy. And so that was an important part. But it was really just a small step because although we have, I think, I can't say exactly how many panels it is. I should know, but I do know it makes up about 10% of our electrical consumption that we now generate on that rooftop solar array. But a very exciting project for us coming in 2021 is a new solar canopy that will be built over the parking lot that we have on Carroll Road. And that one, I've been working on it, so I know that it does have 237 solar panels on it. Wow. And it will help us generate an additional 50% of our electrical needs through the sun, so a total of about 60%. I'm really excited about that project coming online. We're going to kick off the building in the spring as soon as weather permits to construct that project. We also have a number of programs to you know, reduce our consumption of water, reduce our production of waste, to recycle all the materials we possibly can. And as well, we have an innovative wastewater treatment system because we're in a rural area without a municipal wastewater plant. We built our own wastewater pretreatment system to treat the high biological strength wastewater from the brewery before it's discharged to a leach field, even much cleaner than even household waste from a common three bedroom house.
Mm-hmm. Wow! And of course, with all that solar power, that just gives a little bit more sunshine into Double Sunshine, Sip of Sunshine, and your others, right?
It does. It's a great thrill to know that our that our line of sunshine beers is being produced with sunshine made right here in Vermont.
You mentioned 2018. You built really one of the finest. There's that word again, but one of the finest tasting rooms around. It's large, but it's warm and friendly. So how do you do that? It's this big, beautiful building, and yet you feel like you're at home when you're in that building in your tasting room.
Well, you know, Karen, I put so much thought, time, and effort into the planning and design of the tap room. We wanted it to be both beautiful and made with as many local materials as possible. But as you said, we wanted it to be warm, welcoming, inviting, family friendly. We had we have an area that's devoted to kids with games for young kids and older kids, and we wanted it to be a community gathering place. And that's one of the things we really are missing here in the pandemic is not having the tap room open. We've been closed for inside service since March. We did have beer garden service over the summer, but now we're doing a really nice drive-through business at our Waitsfield tap room. And I know I'm really looking forward to the day, hopefully soon in 2021, when, based on public health information, we can get back to having the indoor tap room open again. But in the meantime, folks can order online or just simply drive up to our Waitsfield location and order a variety of beers, and we've ramped up our to-go food program. But I'm really missing the tap room, looking forward to being able to gather with folks again there in the new year. And it's one of the central parts of the beer industry and brewing is gathering people. So it's one of those things that has been really missing, whether it's just for our employees or for the community. But so many regulars that we have in the Mad River Valley and beyond that would come in to meet up, and we look forward to getting back to that.
A couple other things I want to note when it is reopened, because I got to go a couple times when it was opened. You don't have to elbow other people for position around the bar. There's a line, you know, if you're not sitting at the bar, if you're sitting elsewhere, you civilly wait in a line to be served. The line moves quite fast, which is another great design of the operation there, Sean.
Well, thanks. It's one of the parts of the service model that we adapted that we thought would really serve the guest experience well, and that is, you know, serve your, basically serve yourself at the bar. We've really changed around our business model completely since then, and I'm not sure exactly what it will look like when we reopen. But you know, we pivoted over the summer to doing reservations and table service, which was new for us. But as it were before. You mentioned, yes, you walk up and you get your beer and order food at the bar and then get a buzzer. And when your food's ready, it comes out at the kitchen window to pick up. And folks can choose to sit wherever they please. But those bar seats, those are the most coveted ones in the house. They fill up first, those bar stools.
I think in the Valley.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, when it was open, you had kind of early closing hours. I think it was like 7 during the week, maybe 8 at night. And that was for a very specific reason, if I'm correct.
Well, one of the reasons we chose those hours is that we're not really a restaurant. We don't have a full kitchen, and we don't serve, you know, we don't serve like kind of a full restaurant style menu. We do have light fare, and we've expanded upon that for our to-go menu. But our business model was based on trying not to compete directly with the local restaurants, because they really, they need the customer's business as much as we do, and especially during the shoulder seasons when there are less tourists around the Mad River Valley. We didn't want to compete directly with restaurants. We also didn't really want to be a bar, per se. More of a place for folks to gather, enjoy a beer, have some light fare to pair with their beer, and we encourage folks to visit one of the many great restaurants that we have here in the Valley.
I learned that the best strategy is to leave about a half hour before Lawson's closes and beat it on over to Worthy Burger to beat the rush. So that's the best way. Great beer, great burger. Hey, tell us about some new beers you've got there.
Well, we have this holiday season has been great for new options. We had a longtime favorite that was one of my earliest beers, Steve's Backyard Red, a collaboration with local home brewer Steve Robbins. That's available in cans for the first time, as well as we joke about it's almost a forgotten style. We have a black IPA that's out right now. It's called Big Hoppy, also another one of the early beers that's made its way into cans for the first time. And then we have two really special limited releases in bottles, and that is our annual Maple Triple Ale, and that's one of my favorite projects of the year. I work with local farmer Dave Hartshorn to source concentrated maple sap during the spring, and I replace the water in the beer with this concentrated sap to make the Maple Triple. It's a real doozy of a beer. It comes out at about 12% alcohol. It's a sipper, and after it's brewed, it's rested in oak barrels that previously held a maple liqueur called Sapling from Saxton's River Distillery down in Brattleboro. And then after a year, it blended up with some of the fresh beer, bottle it. And it is, it's one of our most recognized beers. It's been awarded three times a medal at the World Beer Cup, which is the largest beer competition in the world. And then to round it out, we have another special barrel-aged beer, our PX Rum Barrel-Aged Faistin Maple Imperial Stout. It's a mouthful to say and to taste as well. And those barrels, we worked with local distiller, Mad River Distillers, and we got their PX Rum barrels once they had emptied out the rum and put the stout in and rested it for over a year before we blended it up and bottled. So those are all available at our drive-through location in Waitsfield, and folks can order online, call, or simply drive up.
I love when someone can describe one of their creations as a real doozy. That's the Maple Triple. Sounds fabulous. Sean Lawson,
it's a great dessert beer, and if you got a day off, it's a wonderful breakfast beer too to pair with your maple glazed donuts from the Big Picture Theater across the street on the weekends.
That's fantastic. Sean Lawson is the CEO and founding brewer of Lawson's Finest Liquids. Sean, it's been a pleasure getting to meet you this morning.
I appreciate you having me on. Thanks so much, Rick.
All right, take care. CBS News is next, and then we'll be back to find out what Catamount Arts has going on in the kingdom. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The pandemic marches on, but you have to take care of yourself through it all, and that includes your spirit being buoyed by the arts. One organization that has been doing that for residents of the Northeast Kingdom and all of Vermont is Catamount Arts in St. Johnsbury. We're going to spend the next half hour learning about what they're offering, including tomorrow night on First Night. Joining us now to let us know all about that is Ashley Van Zandt. She's the Director of Development and Communications for Catamount Arts. Ashley, thanks for joining us on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you've got a question about Catamount Arts or if you've enjoyed one of their presentations, give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ashley, what exactly is Catamount Arts?
Sort of an all-inclusive arts organization over here in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. We sort of dabble in it all. We are a live performance arts organization. We bring both local and more regional and global artists to the area for performances. We have two gallery spaces in our building. We have two theaters that we during the non-pandemic time we have film screenings there. We rent movies. We're interested in all areas that we can integrate arts into the community. We have a full arts education program. And we also have a stringed instrument program called the Epic Music Program. And it's based on the El Sistema model, where we go into schools and teach students primarily violin, but we've also branched out to cello as well.
And before the pandemic, as you said, when you were able to have live performances, what were some of the performances that you brought into Catamount Arts there in St. Jay?
Yeah, there's so many.
I know.
So we have a series called the KCP Presents Series, and that's a series that would run from the fall, sometimes September and October, to the springtime, usually April, but sometimes they went into May. And so we would bring in artists, a lot of them sort of traveling from one area to the next. So we were pretty fortunate in getting folks that we normally wouldn't see in the Northeast Kingdom to kind of stop here. So just to name a few, we would have the Choir of Clare College from Cambridge. Earlier this year, we were supposed to have the Peking Acrobats. We would have Havana Cuba All-Stars have come a couple of times. They're a very fun music group.
Yep. The KCP Presents show, I think you have a virtual one going on right now. Am I correct about that?
That's right, yeah. The Celtic family Christmas, thanks to Natalie McMaster and Donnell Leahy. They, they've come a couple of times for some live performances in Fuller Hall. And gosh, are they fun.
Yeah.
They've done a couple of holiday performances for us and have the whole family out on the stage. And they're just a really nice group of people. So they are offering a virtual concert and as a fundraiser. And they're doing this with a number of other arts organizations. They understand the need for this sort of thing and have offered to try to help us out. So, yeah, if people go to the Catamount Arts website, the banner should be up still for that.
Yep.
But there's, yes, the banner's still up. And it's a virtual concert at home with them. So
yeah, it's really special. And that website, which I really love, is catamountarts.org. Do you mind if we stroll around a little bit and talk about what's there?
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, I want to start with films. And this is really pretty neat. You can rent or watch some fabulous films for $5. So tell us a little bit about that program.
Yeah, so the we are the maybe the last remaining sort of blockbuster. There's a lot of people who stream movies now, but we have a full library. And for those listeners who might even still have a VHS player, we have quite the VHS collection behind one of our movie theaters. It's quite the sight. Yeah, so all of our movies that we have on hand are right up on our website. They can just click on the film tab, and then over on the left it says Film Rental Library, and you can search any movie. If you know, if the building were open right now, we do have them all in binders that a lot of our members and regular patrons go in and they'll sort of check out what we've got, and we'll grab a couple at a time. We also have a staff member who has been working in the box office regularly since we closed our doors in March. Mm-hmm. His name is Martin. And if you call the box office and you talk to Martin, he has office hours Tuesdays and Thursdays for sure in the afternoon. But he checks in more regularly than that. So if you leave a message, he'll call back. He is excellent with the movies. He'll, if you've got one in mind, then he does the digging, the science work with it, trying to figure out what you're looking for.
Wow.
And then, yeah, he's able to set that up for you, which is very exciting. So
beautiful.
Now
you also did the drive-in movies this summer.
We did. Yeah. We had a series that we called Drive In to Stay Safe. And we had, it was movies and also concerts alternating weeks in the parking lots of NVU Johnson and NVU Linden throughout July and August. And those were weekly. And, yeah, so 1 week we would have a movie in Johnson at the Johnson campus, and then that same week we would have the concert at the Linden campus, and then the following week we would swap.
Mm.
And so it was really great to see in person our regulars, you know, our patrons, our the people who we've missed seeing in person, to be able to see them for a couple of minutes in their car, sending them to their parking spot was really great. Organizationally for us, it was just a great program because it really gave us a chance to sort of put into place those safety measures that Governor Scott was recommending, and you know, figuring out the best ways that we could still bring arts to our people, but keeping everybody safe.
Another thing that people can access at catamountarts.org are operas. How do people go about doing that?
Yeah, we have, so in our non-pandemic world, we have, we screen the Met Opera and the National Theater right on our screen, and it's sort of a big deal for people who enjoy those sorts of performances, but right now they're just not, we're not able to do that. So if you go onto our website, and you can just scroll down, it's right on that main page in a calendar. We have it listed, each performance by day. And so if you click on that, then it'll bring you to a the next page where you can read about it, and then you can click right onto the link to watch it.
That's beautiful. Do you sometimes start, you know, just start tooling around your website there and do nothing but experience great art? Go ahead. Ashley, you can admit it to me. Do you do that?
Yeah, no, I do. It's fun for me to go back and see some of the things that we've done. I have it up here just to, you know, quick confirm if I'm saying that something's there. I want to make sure that it is there. Yeah. But just looking through, we've done a lot of projects through the pandemic, and one of the first ones that we had done, I think it was the second one that was really geared toward the pandemic, but we called it the Kingdom COVID Chronicles, and it was a journaling community art outreach project. Where we provided people with prompts and encouraged them to journal about them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually one that I did personally aside from Catamount. And I found it to be just so, you know, during a time of uncertainty back in March, we thought maybe by this time we'd be having an in-person first night celebration. And that is, the world is not much different than it was back in March.
No.
Perhaps it's worse. But that project, you know, kept everybody engaged, kept the arts moving and alive. It brought community together when we had to be separate. If your neighbors were thinking about the same prompts as you, then that sort of, you know, it levels the playing field of the art world. It's, you know, it's connecting everybody. And that was a fun project. So things like that, when I remember the project, but when I'm deep within other projects, it is easy to sort of forget about those. So going through the website and seeing everybody's, you know, in this specific example, all of the journals, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was a really great, fun project.
Well, if Ashley gets nothing else done today, it's my fault. I got her back on that website. First night is tomorrow night. Ashley, what's going to take place and where?
Gosh, we are so excited about first night. I can't even tell you.
You must. You have to tell me.
Okay, I guess I will tell you. So I've been with Catamount Arts for 4 years now, and when I got hired, the executive director, Jody Freed, had said to me, you can be hired, but you have to work New Year's Eve first night. And I didn't know exactly what that meant at the time, but I was like, yes, please, let's do it. And I immediately was integrated into the event pretty heavily. It was my first project. It was once my email was set up and I learned Google Drive. That's what I was doing, fundraising for first night, and putting together the marketing materials, organizing volunteers. It was really who I was at the organization for those first few months. And so first night is so near and dear to my heart. It sort of feels like my baby. And earlier this year, early on in the summer, maybe late spring, early summer, it was looking like, gosh, maybe things are not going to clear up as quickly as we thought maybe we're not going to be able to have first night. Mm. And I sat in on, you know, whatever Zoom call that was, and I was like, please, no, is there a way we can figure this out?
Right.
And so we took a little bit of mental time off, and then we rallied, and we said, there has to be a way that we can make this work. And so we contacted our friends at Kingdom Access Television here in St. Johnsbury, and they bought into our crazy idea, I guess is what I'll call it. So the program is 8 hours long, which is our typical length of time for our first night celebration, 4 p.m. to midnight.
Mm-hmm.
There truly is something for everyone. There's comedy, there's magic, there's dance. There's music of all kinds, storytelling. It's, we really, you know, in a typical first night year, we hire 300 artists, and we have about 100 performances throughout mm-hmm. the evening. And obviously we're not able to do that this year, but we wanted to, have the maximum amount of artists and performers, along with that very unique and special mixture that is first night. And I think that we've done a pretty good job trying to encompass all of what first night typically is into a virtual event. So so this was a program that we curated and that we have organized ahead of time. It is a pre-recorded sort of puzzle piece that we put all together, and that's being distributed actually right now all across the state for everyone to view. Most of the performances, all but one off the top of my head, were created for this program specifically. There's one that was pre-recorded, which is a circus act, but it's more difficult to perform that to nobody, to just a camera to yourself.
Right.
But all the rest of them are special for our program. They're unique, and we're so very excited for that.
So on a normal first night, mm-hmm. what will happen, Ashley, is you're in town, you're wandering around, and it's a mm-hmm. nice family event. And at 3 o'clock, you can look at your schedule, and there's, you know, I don't know, a dozen different things you can do at 3, and then at 4, you know, each hour or each half hour, things are changing, and you kind of, I always circle, and I'm, you know, deciding how yep. I get from one to the next. So will it be on, this is all virtual now, so will you have different things at each hour block or each time period to choose from, or, you know, how does it go?
Yep. So what happens so a typical first night, program starts at 4 and you have the program guide with you, and we have anywhere, depending on the year, we have 15 to 18 venue sites. So you know, pick your place and then you go and you check out what is happening there. For our program, the platform that we used, it's not a choice to sort of go back and forth to different performances. But what we did was we have the schedule, and so it starts at 4, and then at 4 o'clock we'll have the welcome, which is Jay Sprout, who is actually on the board at Catamount Arts. But he was part of the team that first put together the first night north in St. Johnsbury back in 1993. So Jay Sprout is a very important member of our team. I mean, he gives a brief history at the beginning, but then we move right into the performances. And let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, so each hour has approximately 7 performances. And they run from, you know, maybe 5 to 8 minutes long. There might be a couple that are a bit longer and a bit shorter. So it's constantly flowing. You're constantly engaged. If there's maybe a particular genre of music that you're not incredibly fond of, you know, then that's your 3 minutes to run to the bathroom. And then once you get back, then something new is on and, it's engaging. So we have, each hour there's a healthy mix of various music. There's dance, there's comedy, and then there's magic and, circus performances sort of spread throughout.
So there's two advantages to this over the normal.
Yep.
One is, you know, there would always be on any schedule conflicting performances. You want to be in two places at once. Yes. You don't have to worry about that. And the other thing
That's
is, as much as I love First Night, there have been years where I have scrap plans when it gets a little icy or just too bitter. But this year, you don't have to worry about that, right? Doesn't matter what the weather is like.
That's right. You've got your fuzzy slippers on. You're on your couch.
Yep.
You're streaming it. It's totally fine. You've got, we're encouraging people to do takeout just to support local businesses.
Oh, nice.
But, you know, plan ahead for that, folks. I think that the restaurants are going to have a busy night, and if you're wanting to eat at 6, don't call at 5:30. it is exciting. So it is typically cold, but it's funny. Usually at this time in a normal year, I am checking the weather forecast every 20 minutes, and I'm calling up Mark Breen at the Fairbanks Museum and saying, Mark, what do you have for us? You know, any new updates? It's really quite different this year for me. I haven't even looked at the weather forecast.
Oh, good for you. One less bit of stress. And Bobby from over at the Fairbanks Museum, Bobby Ferlise Rubio, is in Tritium Well. They're going to be doing an after party.
So he's in Tritium Well, and he's just a great soul. So he's performing. We've got them twice toward the end of the evening, which is typically when they play anyway. But he also has an interview with Modern Times Theater. I'm not sure if any of your listeners are familiar with Modern Times Theater, but it's Justin and Rose, and they are half of Vermont Vaudeville, and they have their own company. They're quite hilarious, and so we worked with them creating this sort of storyline-ish throughout the program with a character of Justin's named Safety Officer Jim. And it is a riot. Let me tell you, it's just full belly laughs. He's just great entertainment. And he does a full set interview with Bobby at the Fairbanks Museum.
All right. Now, I'm going to ask you one more question, Ashley. You got to answer it in like 15 seconds. What is a ball raising?
Yes, so please stay to the end. It's our, it's the ball raising, which is our ball of lights, similar to the one in New York City, but ours is bigger. And the New York City ball drops, and we raise ours up because we're ready for the new year to be raised up.
Fantastic. Ashley Van Zandt is the Director of Development and Communications at Catamount Arts. To learn more about First Night, you can visit catamountarts.org. Ashley, thank you so much for being on with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
All right. Have a great First Night. Let's take a few moments for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to visit a wonderful little Vermont hamlet, Kent's Corner. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Travel around this brave little state, and you are going to find some lovely places that you didn't know about. You'll be amazed how some wee hamlet has a really big story to tell. One of those is Kent's Corner in Calais. There's the Kent Museum, the Old West Church, the Robinson Sawmill. In the mid-19th century, it was booming. In the mid-20th century, noteworthy cookbooks were being written here. It's places like Kent's Corner why folks from away come to visit Vermont, and it's also a great reason for you to get to know your own state intimately. Joining me now to tell the tale of Kent's Corner is David Sheets. He's the chair of Historic Kent's Corner, Inc. David, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having us.
Oh, I'm delighted. And many of you will also know David as the state curator. If you'd like to ask David a question or if you want to share something you've experienced on a visit to Kent's Corner, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. David, when did you first learn of the charms and history of this hamlet?
I moved to Vermont 41 years ago to work at the State House on the project that would eventually be my job as state curator. But I remember my friend, Phil Elbert, who at that time was the curator of the Vermont Historical Society, telling me about this great little museum out in Kent's Corner, and he gave me directions. And I got hopelessly lost.
I knew it.
So it was one of my first experiences getting lost in Vermont. And now that I live in Kent's Corner, it's astonishing to me that I could possibly have gotten lost.
True.
It's 10 miles north of Montpelier off the county road. You just take a right, and less than a mile from the county road is Kent's Corner. So it's pretty easy to get there, and it is a wonderful place. At that time, the museum, what locals still call the Kent Museum, had been a museum since the early 50s, when the Vermont Historical Society took over this big brick tavern of the 1830s. And it's a wonderful place. I never thought I'd end up living here, but I've been here now for 21 years and very happy because it's a special community in addition to being a great place for people to visit.
Yeah, it really is. Let's get a little history lesson. Do we know much about it before settlers arrived to that area?
Well, the Kents for whom Kent's Corner is named, remember Kent, came up from Connecticut, along with many other settlers who were moving into Vermont in the late 18th century. And he built his first house in Kent's Corner, a house that still stands, although it was moved down the hill from the original location. And his sons were enterprising people who had a lot of businesses in addition to being simply farmers in the area. They eventually owned the oldest sawmill in Vermont, the Robinson Sawmill, which is just steps away from Kent's Corner and still stands. 1803 is when that building was first constructed. And they had a brickyard, they had a shoe factory, surprisingly, which no longer stands, but was right next to the general store that the Kents ran, that is connected to the Stagecoach Inn that he built in, that Abdiel Kent built in 1837. And at that time, the Old West Church Road, which goes alongside the museum, was on the principal route between Boston and Montreal.
Wow.
So it was a lot busier than it would eventually be after trains and other modes of transportation superseded the stagecoaches that were the principal travel at that time. And it's left those vestiges of Vermont's past behind, and thus in the 20th century, Mrs. Kent, who was married into the family in the early 20th century, she was a Boston socialite who married A. Kent, and she summered in the community, and it was Kent's Corner became a summer community in the mid-20th century as a result of her efforts. She brought a lot of other people to the community and entertained, wrote these magnificent books on, and is best known as Mrs. Appleyard.
Right. We'll get to her. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, David, so in the mid-19th century, it was really booming, you know. So what was going on there? You mentioned a shoe factory. Were there other things being produced there?
Yes, they had a blacksmith shop that also still stands. They had harness-making shops. Leather was apparently abundant because not only were they making shoes, but they were making harnesses as well. What's great about Kent's Corner is it's not a unique story at all.
Right.
This is the Vermont story in the middle of the 19th century. There were hamlets like Kent's Corner all over Vermont. What is unusual about it is the degree to which it still is well preserved and the collection that is still to this day at the Vermont Historical Society that documents a lot of this activity it's very well documented. Mm. So it is that reason that Kent's Corner has been looked to by first the Vermont Historical Society and now by the Division for Historic Preservation, who maintain the museum to this day. They all understand that this is a great place to tell Vermont's late 18th, early 19th century story.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is still with us.
Now, Atwater Kent gets involved, so you're going to have to tell people, because we're probably a couple generations removed from Atwater Kent being a household name, who he was and how he got involved with Kent's Corner.
Sure. Well, Atwater Kent was a cousin of the Kents that were in Kent's Corner, and he was an early radio magnate, a pioneer in the development of radio early in the 20th century. Lived in Philadelphia. There's a beautiful museum in Philadelphia to this day that is the Atwater Kent Museum. And so he had an interest in the past. He had very much an interest in his own roots in Vermont. And Mrs. Kent, the one who founded the museum, was conscious of him and drew him into her project to restore this old brick tavern and make it into a museum. And she saw that his money might be useful to the project. So he funded the early development of the Kent Museum, her restoration of the buildings, and to this day, the Vermont Historical Society maintains a small fund that Atwater Kent gave them to run the museum and to continue to use its collections to advantage. They preserve the collections in their collection in Barrie, at the Vermont History Center, and that's a great thing to this day that we had the ability to use Atwater Kemp's money to advantage over the years.
Phenomenal. David, I want to talk about someone you brought up, Mrs. Appleyard, who was a rock star in her own right. Please tell people about Mrs. Appleyard.
She would enjoy being known as a rock star, Rick. She was a force. I think that's the right word to use. Uh-huh. In that, this is a woman that I have really come to appreciate and, in fact, love without ever having known her myself. Her granddaughters, happily, are still very active members of our community.
Oh, wow.
The best known of the two of them is Janet Ansel, is our representative to the Vermont legislature. And Janet lives just above Kent's Corner in a house that she's building right now, a new house for herself. So she's been one of the ways I've come to appreciate her grandmother, because I've had first-hand testimony from both she and Olivia Gay, who is another major member of our community. So she was a woman who made things happen. And, you know, the Kemp Museum would not have happened, clearly, without her active interest in looking at this old building that had fallen out of the family's ownership by that time. And she lived in a house next door and was appreciating that the building was not being well cared for. So that was her mission, was to bring this building back to life. And she did so, as we said, by bringing Atwater Kemp in for funding, but she actively worked on the restoration of the building herself. So she was very much a do-it-yourselfer, and wrote books that were oriented toward a young audience that she was trying to engage in history. So she would take a figure from the past and write a book aimed at kids to get them involved in history. She also entertained a lot, and picnics and barbecues, things like that were central to her happiness, and she wanted to share that with a wider audience. So her books have a very wry sense of humor, and they're also great ways to figure out how to entertain and keep people happy with food at the center of their existence. She later had a column in Vermont Life magazine about food, and she would present the food with beautiful photographs get people inspired. You know, it's a big part of our world now, right? We have television and radio that is oriented toward entertaining and this kind of thing. Back in her day, it was delivered with cookbooks, and her wry sense of humor comes through. They're very I'm not a cook myself, but they're very entertaining to read because of that wit that she had.
We're going to take a call here from Elliot, who's joining us from East Montpelier. Elliot, thanks for calling this morning.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Is this Elliot Morse?
Yeah.
This is Elliot Morse.
Hello,
Elliot.
Oh, good. I'm waiting to go to work at 12:30 at O'Reilly's. I shouldn't have said that because that's an ad, I guess. I love that place. But I wanted to first quickly tell you about the stagecoach that went from Montpelier to Memphis Magog, the road from Montpelier to Canada. And they'd come up by the Old West Church, the horses clip-clopping along, pulling the stagecoach with probably happy people, maybe some unhappy people because they were riding on the top of it.
Oh, right.
It was cold up there. And the driver, his name was Truman Way. I found his grave up in Woodbury a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And he was a joker. He'd stand up in front of the seat, and he'd say, "I am the way, the only way, the true way."
And, that is great.
Then they'd pull up. I think there's a door that's quite high at the Kent Tavern, Kent Museum.
There is.
And the people with money would ride inside. The ones that had not much would ride on top in the weather. And this driver would pull the stagecoach right up under that door, which is around 8 feet high, and they'd get off, and they'd go into the hotel that way.
Mm.
Wow. Elliot is a descendant of the Kent family as well.
Oh, he's my.
Another major family, the Morses, the Fitches, and the Kents. They're all integral to the story of our part of Calais.
Oh, yeah. The Robinsons, too. Yep. Joel Robinson came from Rehoboth, Massachusetts in 1792, and he was my great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Wow.
And he built that mill in 1803, which is still probably the best-kept mill in Vermont.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And Elliot.
Getting even better, as Elliot is suggesting, the Robinson Sawmill is a place that the public can visit anytime they're in Kent's Corner. It's free of charge. You can observe it, but the board has been working steadfastly to restore that building as well and to eventually dredge the mill pond to make it a little easier to run the sawmill itself for special occasions. So that's another great effort that's happening in Kent's Corner, along with restorations at both the Old West Church and down the hill Calais's Town Hall, all of which are in the same historic district as the museum and surround it, which gives you this great 19th century context to appreciate a typical Vermont hamlet of that time.
It really does. David, we're almost out of time, but I do want to mention one more thing. I got really jazzed for Kent's Corner in a big way when I attended my first Art at the Kent show a few years ago. So just tell people a little bit. I know it had to be outside this year. Hopefully 2021, it'll be back in its full glory. But tell people a little bit about Art at the Kent.
Well, the museum is now essentially an empty complex of this old inn and general store. And when you come to the Kent over the past decade, you've enjoyed, particularly in the month of September into October, an art show, contemporary art, shown in the context of these old buildings. And that was not the original mission of the Kent, but it certainly is the mission now that the Division for Historic Preservation and our group have presented Art at the Kent. And this year, we're doing a show called 2020 Hindsight, along with many other museums throughout Vermont. We're part of the Vermont Curators Group. And in 2020, we were looking back. We ended up just doing the outdoor part of the show for obvious reasons. We hope this coming September to do the entire full-blown show inside and outside as part of 2020 Hindsight. And we'll be looking back at this past year. In addition to
David, we're going to have to leave it right there. That's David Sheets. He's chair of Historic Kent's Corner, Inc. You can go to kentscorner.org and check out all that. David, thanks so much for being with us
today. Thank you for having me, Rick.
And I'm Rick Singeri. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.